The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Georgia has a new U.S. senator, but is this just the start instead of the end of the sharp elbows among the state's Republicans? Meanwhile, both major parties get their ballots together for the upcoming presidential primary, and the numbers keep flying in the debate over health care in this state. Thanks for joining us for the Political Breakfast. After a few days where actual adults clobbered each other on social media over who wears jean shorts, we've got some grown-up conversation for you. I'm Dennis O'Hare, along with some immaculately dressed companions. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away, filling in for him, Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Hey, welcome, and very nice outfits. Not a jean short to be found.
I'm somewhat close. Jean shorts would be a little dressy for me right now. I look like I just rolled out of a teenager's gym class.
I think it's a little too nippy outside for jean shorts, so yeah. I'll take the long jeans today.
There you go. Well, as expected, Governor Brian Kemp named businesswoman Kelly Loeffler as Georgia's new senator, replacing Johnny Isaacson, who's retiring for health reasons. She immediately pledged her loyalty to President Trump. But unless a miracle happens, by the time the likely impeachment trial of the president starts in the Senate, Loeffler's going to be one of the jurors. Yeah. Now, she had to establish her bona fides with the president's supporters in the state, who are skeptical of her. But will other voters, Brian, look at her as exactly what the Democrats claim she will be, a blindly loyal follower of the president who will not look at facts in the impeachment trial or anyplace else seriously?
What Democrats are saying is that if you don't reach the same conclusion based on those facts, then you are therefore ignoring the facts. So I just discard that.
But how much sense does it make to say up front, as one of your first things, I'm loyal to the president?
She has absolutely no choice on that. If she is going to come out there and confirm the Republican criticism of her from the right, that she's a rhino, that she's not a true conservative, that we can't trust her on the issues that are important to us. If she comes out and confirms, though, she's dead in the water. I mean, this would be a one-year stint for her. If she wants to have a chance of winning outright in November or being the Republican who gets into the runoff in January of 2021, she has got to have the support of Trump's most fervent supporters. Now, you're seeing a split amongst a lot of those in the state right now. You're seeing many of them attacking Brian Kemp over this choice because President Trump has very vocally and repeatedly said he wanted Doug Collins to get that appointment. But the president is going to play a big role moving forward. He's handcuffed to some degree, as much as he's ever handcuffed by anything, because Kelly Loeffler, we know now, will sit in judgment of President Trump and will have a vote. Now, she would be ending her political career if she voted to convict him. It'll be done for her. So she's a little handcuffed, too. But is Trump going to go out and actively attack someone who's going to have a vote in that impeachment process when he really wants to have a unified Republican vote in his favor? Because having any Republican come off to peel off and vote with the Democrats would hurt the overall messaging effort. So both of them are a little bit in a box. But as soon as that's over, Trump is perfectly free to go back to lobbying on Twitter for Doug Collins And if he goes out and makes the case that the U.S. senator from Georgia isn't conservative enough, isn't loyal enough to him, and we need Doug Collins, it's very difficult for her to message through that, right? Trump's voice is so much louder and so much more important. But we don't know that Trump's going to do it. She does have a chance to win
him
over.
She's got a little time.
She has a little bit of time. And Doug Collins, if he's going to run, has a very short time frame.
Yeah, we're going to get to him in just a second. Let me bring Bianca into this. Bianca, Democrats now have to take advantage of the, at least for the moment, divisions within the Republican ranks. They got to get candidates into this all-comers primary. What strategy do they have to employ, and who do they go get?
I think the American public is a far cry from, you know, where President Trump and Governor Kemp are sitting. And I think that those two factors alone are enough to create a pathway towards getting a person in there that won't go and be a rubber stamp for corruption. In an environment where our very democracy is under attack.
But you need candidates who are going to have money, resources, support, name recognition, because even if Doug Collins jumps into the race, you're going to have two Republicans with a lot of resources, and they could end up in the runoff and freeze the Democrats out the way this election is structured.
True, true. But there are some very, very great candidates that are already in the race for the Democratic nomination for at least Purdue seat. And when it comes to when it comes to the Isaacson seat, I imagine that some of those folks that are now vying for Purdue seat might actually switch over and run for Isaacson seat. Now,
who are the likely ones, do you think, to do that?
I don't have any guesses on that, but I will say that it has been easier.
Teresa Tomlinson, Mayor Ted Terry, and others.
It's been a very clear messaging point to attack Senator Purdue. And so when you didn't have a candidate named for who would succeed Isaacson, it was much easier for the more established candidates to go ahead and say, hey, you know, this is how I'm different. This is what I'm going to add. You know, John Ossoff has been doing a great job with that. Sarah Riggs Amico and Teresa Tomlinson, they've been out there killing it. But I do believe that the Democratic Party.
That's some spin. The killing it, that's some spin. That's fine. That's what you're here for. That's fine.
Anyway, I do believe that the Democratic Party will benefit by making sure that we do have a person of color that actually runs and competes in for one of these Senate seats. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to make all the difference.
There's been a lot of talk about that, that eventually a candidate of color will surface for the Isaacson seat. Anybody making moves to jump in?
None publicly, but there have been a lot of conversations with various prospective candidates that I do believe will emerge and run for that seat.
Stacey Abrams will not be talked into it?
Look, Stacey Abrams has already made her point
she's
clear.
She's been very clear. Yeah.
She's been very clear. But she also is a very defined leader in an executive role. She's not going to go and be, you know, one of many.
Brian, let's come back to Doug Collins. You said he doesn't have a lot of time to make a decision here. He was coolly diplomatic in his statement after the press conference by Governor Kemp. He congratulated Kelly Loeffler, saying he respects the governor's decision. He's got an impeachment hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee to worry about, where he's the ranking minority member. Is he all in for a run next year?
I think the fact that he was out with a statement quickly, I would say for a week at least, he's known he's going to put out that statement. That suggests that he is making steps toward running. The impeachment hearing is going to give him a platform with which our soon-to-be senator can't even compete with, which is hard to believe. Any senator almost always going to have a much bigger platform than a House member. This is an ironic situation, the timing of this. Doug's got another star turn for the next 2 to 3 weeks and will be making national news. And you'll continue to see people like Sean Hannity talking about how great he is and what a strong conservative fighter he is. So the timing for him really is extraordinary to have this stage on which to perform. Now, we'll see that how Kelly Loeffler performs, she is going to have her opportunity to make a first impression. Georgians don't know her yet. So this next week is going to be her chance to make a first impression, and we know you don't get two chances, so she's got to get it right. But if she does, that's going to give her some stability. It's going to give her some confidence, and she can build on that. I want to touch on what Bianca was talking about. They've got to have a high profile and charismatic and experienced campaigner who is African-American to emerge.
You know, You're talking about the Democrats. Yeah.
Yes. Or just somebody who's an extraordinary talent that we don't know about, right? I don't think anybody knew how extraordinary Stacey Abrams would be when she first got into the race for governor. And so it took people by surprise. There may be somebody else out there, some other African-American who's coming up through the system who's going to be extraordinary. But I think about Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County, who's interesting because he's a known quantity in Metro Atlanta. White voters trust mm-hmm. him and like him.
He ran against Isaacson last time.
And it, with a very clean, very, very positive campaign.
The dullest Senate campaign in history. He would say mean things about each other.
Right. But Michael Thurman wasn't trying to win
respect
that.
There.
You know, Michael Thurman was not trying to win that race. He was just being a team player so the Democrats have a name on the ballot. And that's what happened. He would have to run a very different, more aggressive and nasty campaign this time if he wants to win. But you want to look at who the Democrats going to match up Kelly Loeffler with if Doug doesn't get in. Now, if Doug gets in, it's chaos. I mean, blood on the floor. It's going to be so much fun to watch from the sidelines.
I'm going to put down my popcorn.
Yeah, yeah. But if it's Kelly Loeffler and no other Republican, you got to think Jen Jordan, the senator from Sandy Springs, Buckhead area, state senator, who has gained a lot of respect for her intelligence, her savvy, her work ethic in the state Senate in a very short period of time. She would be an interesting candidate to watch and might match up really well. She, you know, grew up poor in rural Georgia, has an interesting story, and she's, you know, savvy. I've told Republican senators, like, when she's down on the floor, don't engage her, man, because I promise you she's prepared.
Bianca Kelly Loeffler, if she gains momentum, does she pose a unique challenge for Democrats in that she might help Republicans win back some of those suburban voters, independents, moderates, women who have moved away from the GOP lately?
I don't believe that will be the case. I mean, Kelly Loeffler is speaking the same narrative that has had a lot of folks walk away from the Republican Party, including a lot of the suburban white women who have, you know, not taken to the idea of building a wall or being overly restrictive on abortion rights. And Kelly is more of the same. But can we talk for a minute about how this whole process was supposed to be guaranteed transparency? Let's go back to when Brian Kemp first put out the application for this U.S. Senate role. I mean, he has taken a complete page out of Donald Trump's apprentice handbook. He made this whole thing into a stage. You have all these applications, folks applying. You cart these people out, you know, for months. You're carting them out with their resumes, posting them online. And then in the last 10 minutes, Kelly Loeffler applies, and then the portal closes. And now you're spatting with Donald Trump to show that you actually have some gravitas to stand on your own. This whole thing was a setup. This whole thing was a setup. And as far as I'm concerned, it was expected. This theatrical show is not what the public wants, and they will reject it.
But is that something that Democrats can actually use, that people will care enough about to vote on come next year, or will this whole mess have faded into the rearview mirror and they'll be voting on things like the economy or
the Republicans
whatever.
Are going to help us with this one. The Republicans are going to do the lifting on this one. They're going to attack Kelly, Doug, Sean Hannity, Trump, all of them. It's going to be a complete circus.
Brian, is there any repair work Republicans can do, patch up paper over cracks, do that kind of thing, and have a consensus candidate going into a all-comers primary, which may feature somebody pretty high profile on the Democratic side?
This has been a really big deal for a couple of weeks, and if there's anything true in American politics, it's nothing is a big deal for very long, no matter if it seems like it's earth-shattering in its beginnings. There's a chance that we could all move past this. I think some of your base folks, your media outlets who are pro-Trump, who have been against the Loeffler pick, I think they'll move on quickly and they will consolidate if no other Republicans get in. If there's like some alternative, and the only one that we know of is Doug Collins, who's a very legitimate alternative, then the divisions will continue. We're gonna go into this special election as if it is a primary, right? And it's actually a jungle general election where it could be four, five, six candidates. But if it's Doug versus Kelly, they're going to be running as if they're trying to be the Republican nominee in the runoff in January 2021. So it's going to be impossible to bring folks together in that scenario. What we need to see happen, if there are two Republicans in the race, is two or more Democrats in the race, because you don't want two Republicans going at each other's throats and one Democrat staying above the fray and then getting perilously close to that 50% threshold. You know, today, a Democrat running for statewide office begins at about 47.9%. Mm-hmm. So they don't need a huge margin to close it. So that's the danger. But I don't think Democrats – there's so much pent-up demand for holding an office amongst Democrats because they've been shut out of statewide offices, and they see this plum sitting out there, and they think that the state's turned – you know, they got within 55,000 votes last year, and we've registered over 300,000 new voters since. Democrats think the vast majority are Democrats, and they may be right. So Democrats are going to be anxious to get in this race too. So it's just going to be – not just a jungle primary. It's going to be a jungle brawl.
But Bianca, in order for Democrats to get into that runoff or even to perhaps have a chance of winning outright, they're going to have to coalesce, aren't they? Because they can't really afford the kinds of divisions that we're seeing on the Republican side yet.
I would say for both political parties, there is a somewhat of a battle going for the direction.
Yeah, the soul of the party in both cases.
In both cases. And so the Democratic Party has been a bit more civil, but you can see, like, with the Biden, wing versus, like, the Warren and Sanders wing, there is a gap there. And so with candidates coming out, it will be very interesting to see which of the philosophies that they mold themselves in on the Democratic side. And on the Republican side, the one thing that, you know, we do see a lot with Republicans is that they will toe the party line. And Democrats are not quite that party. And I think that's part of the nature of it being a big tent party, which is that you really have to appeal to a broader demographic in order to be successful.
But does that mean, tactically, that Democrats in this race are going to have to unite early on behind one candidate, whatever their differences individually with that candidate might be, and say, okay, here's the horse we're riding because that's our best chance of winning?
I don't see that as a possibility for much of anything in politics today. I mean, it's just not happening. We had more than 20, folks running for president in the Democratic primary. And then with the Republican primary for president in 2016, it was massive. You know, it was a massive field. And so I think, again, what we're seeing right now is a fight for the direction of these political parties.
And they're not going to put it aside for the
no.
tactical reason of uniting to win a Senate seat?
No.
Wow.
No.
I agree with her.
Yeah. Brian, let's turn it around. Is Governor Kemp's relationship with the president past repair because of this? Or, you've got a presidential election, you're coming up. Do they just need each other, even if for the moment they're kind of at odds?
Governor Kemp doesn't really have the liberty of attacking the president or, I think he probably came as close as he's going to get when he tweeted last week, I don't care what the political establishment thinks.
And
you've got to include the president in that. I mean, if he's not the political establishment, I don't know who is. I would say that the governor's part of the political establishment, too. I mean, but that's neither here nor there. The enemies of the day are your partners tomorrow because there'll be a new issue tomorrow where they've got to team up. So, yes, that will get patched up for sure. there's been a relationship there and a good relationship there. And, you know, Brian's not in a position where he can burn that bridge, and the president's going to need Brian again at some juncture. So now,
yeah,
granted,
as we mentioned in our last podcast, Governor Kemp is polling in Georgia ahead of the president right now.
Yeah, yeah, he's in good political shape through really a lot of hard work this year. The schism between them, however, will last through November if Doug gets in. These are two strong-willed people who have planted their feet. They're not going to change their minds. They were going to, would have happened before 10 a.m. Thursday morning.
We can't leave this without talking about Senator Isaacson for a moment. In his farewell speech, he made a point, Bianca, of talking about his friendship with Atlanta Democratic Congressman John Lewis. That was throughout the speech. And he also mentioned the violence in Charlottesville back in 2017 at a white supremacy rally. He said, some people dance around the language of hate. They did at Charlottesville. Were you surprised that that reference came out, number one? And number two, is there anything Democrats can do with it?
I think he was cementing his legacy for bipartisanship with that speech. And while I can't say that I predicted anything that he would say, I do think that there were some very profound messages in that speech. But it was also riddled with paradoxes, too. You know, on one hand, you're talking about hate and you're talking about, you know, Charlottesville, and it is insinuating or suggesting, you know, this legacy. It's kind of paralleling the legacy of the civil rights movement and in contrast with what was happening in Charlottesville. Images evoke, you know, and using the name of John Lewis. And
who was there, by the way?
Who was there? So all of that was really beautiful. But, you know, he also praised Vice President Pence and suggested that he would be president in the short, you know, in the near future. And I don't know if there's something going on there that he was trying to let us know about.
I think he meant, like, you know, in 5 years, not in 5 months.
But there were some good moments in that. And I do appreciate Senator Isaacson. But I wish that overall we were not as polarized in partisanship. And I do believe that the warning that he issued echoed the warnings of many Republicans that have left office over the last 10 years. Many Republicans, senators and representatives have left with this warning that the direction that the Republican Party was going in was essentially ripping the fabric of our democracy.
But Brian, the criticism from some Democrats of Senator Isaacson, including in that speech, is, okay, he said the right things about the language of hate and so forth in the view of the Democrats, but he didn't tie the president to it, even though the president said about Charlottesville there were fine people on both sides, for instance.
Look, Johnny's gone out on numerous occasions, taken the mic on the Senate floor, and taken exception with the comments or actions of President Trump. He certainly did it, for example, when President Trump wouldn't fly the flag at half staff when Senator McCain died. He was livid on the floor in responding. So he has a history of subtly, or in that case overtly, distancing himself from the president. I thought the reference to Charlottesville was an interesting one. It's not what I would have guessed would be in his farewell speech. So that would have been something that came up. Obviously, that's something that is set with him in a way that we didn't know. But it does match up with his history. And this is someone who year after year goes and sits on the stage at Ebenezer Baptist Church on MLK Day, who's often the only Republican in there, and he states for the entire long ceremony, often where it's a partisan Democrat ceremony and Republicans are bashed, and he just sort of politely sits there through it. So, you know, he has not just had rhetoric, he has shown up. You know, he went to Selma with John Lewis and did the march the recreation on the history of that important occasion. So he didn't just on his last day go, hey, you know, we need to do better on race relations. He has lived it, right? And it's part of his important legacy. And I so admire what he has done for the state over all these years. He's the first ever Georgia Republican elected to the U.S. Senate 3 times. He's the only Georgian ever to serve in the state House, state Senate, U.S. House, and U.S. Senate. A remarkable story. And let me finish with this. on the grounds of the state capitol is a giant statue of the Georgia giant, Richard Russell, who served us in the Senate for over 40 years and was critical to so many important programs that we even use today, such as food stamps and building the U.S. military. And I think that even though Johnny wasn't in the U.S. Senate for 40 years and he never became as powerful as Richard Russell was, his overall legacy is someone who merits a statue on the Capitol grounds. You're not going to hear me say that too often. I'm a Nathan Deal guy, but he got the judicial building named for him, which is a tremendous honor. I think an appropriate honor would be to have some likeness of Johnny Isaacson on the Capitol grounds. He is a Georgia treasure.
And there's more on the Political Breakfast still to come, including what's in a name on a ballot, or maybe a bunch of names on a ballot. Stay right here.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Thanks for hanging with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away, filling in this time. The Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Brian Robinson is back with us, one of our regulars, a Republican strategist. Let's pick up on the primary coming up on March 24th. On consecutive days just recently, the two major parties in the state announced who's going to be on the ballot for their Georgia voters in that primary. The state's Republicans said, we've only got one name, Donald J. Trump. Democrats, for their part, put just about everybody in there, 18 names, including Kamala Harris, who withdrew shortly after the Democrats published their list. Brian, does it serve any useful purpose for Georgia Republicans to exclude challengers like William Weld and Joe Walsh, both of whom have government experience, when President Trump's a shoo-in anyway? I mean, what did they have to lose by putting them on the ballot? Instead, they look like they're excluding people.
They look defensive. And they look silly. And I'm appalled by this. And I want to be strong in my language because I said this on the podcast several months ago when other states were either canceling their primaries or not allowing the opponents to get on. We addressed that issue. And I said, I'm glad Georgia's not doing that. Donald Trump would get 80, 90% of a primary vote. It would be a show of strength. And it would be an appropriate exercising of the muscle of democracy here in this state. And to take the choice away is unforgivable, and it strategically makes no sense. You know, if their guy might lose, it still would be wrong. People should still get a voice in that, but their guy's not going to lose. It looks weak. And you know, what do Democrats say about Donald Trump? That he loves authoritarians. He admires and envies how they are able to, crush dissent with police and by rigging elections and not allowing the opposition on the ballot. And so to prove them wrong, we go out and do something like that. It doesn't make any sense to me. There's no danger here. The only danger here is looking foolish. And congratulations, we've done that.
I couldn't have said it better.
Is this another thing that will anger independent voters, those suburban?
No, they don't vote.
Or do they,
no, they
don't vote really
in the Republican
care?
Primary. No. This is about the hardcore Republican primary voters who are Trump supporters. That's the irony of it, right? They want to show up and vote for him. Who wants to go show up and vote for with one name on the ballot? You know, we're missing a chance to identify new Republican voters in the state who show up to vote for Trump, because who's going to bother showing up now?
Bianca, there's been some real anger. Going back to Kamala Harris for a moment, there's been some real anger expressed in social media and elsewhere by some progressives who say Harris's withdrawal, because she just couldn't raise the money, shows how the process favors white candidates, especially white males. I've even seen a few tweets that said, I won't vote for any of them now. Is that a risk for Democrats as they try to flip Georgia the way that the field is shaking out in advance of March 24th?
It'll take some time for us to see how the public really truly responds to this, because her withdrawal from the race was such a shock for many of us, mm-hmm. that
or at least in terms of how quickly it came.
Yes.
Her campaign was in a bit of trouble before.
I mean, the campaign was in a bit of trouble, but I think that this was a very smart and strategic move to ensure that she can continue to do the job as a U.S. senator because of the dates with their primaries and qualifying and so forth. And so in the state of California,
she is on judiciary, so there's an impeachment trial coming up probably.
Yes, yes. And I believe that she knows where her strength is, and even as Donald Trump tries to rip her and say, we'll miss you, she says, and I'll see you at trial. I'm confident in the decision that she made, but at the same time, I will say that I am a bit saddened as a Black woman, and I'll say that first and foremost, because I truly do believe that there was an element of attack against her that was, you know, very unprecedented in many respects. The way in which she was torn down, even though she was polling so high.
You mean at the beginning where she just rocketed?
But still, she was about, you know, ranking about five. Mm-hmm. And so there are all these folks after her that are still in the race, still competing, still trying to be there, and they haven't dropped out. And so I'm looking at this and I'm wondering why. I mean, of course, I know that in terms of just some very basic things with the election, that she needed to make these decisions. I'm disappointed in how her departing staff has gone to other campaigns and then also used their departure as an excuse to tear her down even further.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that because there's something that Theron said in our last podcast where he cited the support from some veteran Democrats here in Georgia for folks like Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. What about young Democratic voters, particularly young Democratic voters of color? Is her departure something that will dampen their enthusiasm for whoever else is on that multi-name ballot?
I think there were more Black women operatives and organizers that were impacted by her departure, specifically because of the struggles that we share in the work and how we're identified and treated. I think when you're talking about the younger Democratic voters and voters of color, I don't know that they were necessarily going to support Kamala Harris. I believe that they may be more likely to support a Warren or a Sanders. That's where I feel like the younger demographic is right now.
I think Kamala Harris had an opportunity. She started out pretty strong. I love her presence on the debate stage because she comes across as very conversational, like she's talking to a bunch of buddies at the dinner table or to her family. And that's what I coach people to do when I'm doing debate training, and I'm not very good at much in life. I can't fix anything. I'm bad at math and science, but I'm really good at debate training. I mean, I think Nathan Deal backed me up. She had what you train to some degree. It didn't look forced. It didn't look fake. It looked smooth and genuine. But the moment where she went after Joe Biden about the having been friends with segregationists and busing, a 50-year-old issue, and then where she took on Elizabeth Warren about having Trump banned from Twitter, those are debate moments that stand out as they looked staged and phony and they didn't work and they hurt her because they cut across from that genuine image that I think that she had done a pretty good job of building up. It is a mystery at this juncture on who young African-American voters are going to go toward. Granted, young voters of any race are the least likely to show up in a primary and vote. So it's not a huge issue for either party. But
those are the voters, Bianca, the Democrats need to get if they want to tip the balance in Georgia. They have to get voters who haven't shown up before. And Brian just pointed out, young voters show up proportionately less often. Those are the ones you got to get.
Well, can I just say that, you know, Pete Buttigieg is surging everywhere else and, you know, in states that are almost overwhelmingly white. And, you know, recent polls have shown that he's pulling at zero. Zero. Like, there's nobody in the sample who is African-American who said they're for Pete Buttigieg. Now, I don't know if they don't know about him yet or if he's just not exciting them or he has the wrong message. I don't know what the lack of connection is. I don't know if it's the LGBTQ, which the New York Times has suggested and AJC has written about. I don't know. But he's the young guy, right? So you would think generationally he would have that appeal.
people are going to vote for a lot of different reasons. I can't exactly say who it is that that I'm, you know, backing right now at this juncture.
And are you typical of a lot of Georgia Democrats? There's a big wait and see.
I think that there are a lot of voters that follow my train of thought. The voters that need to be tapped, that are looking for a reason to come out and vote. The voters that are saying we don't want more of the same. We actually want a person that's going to invest in us to be more of a doer than saying the right things. People are tired. They are tired of this hamster wheel that it seems like we've been on. The Republicans said, hey, we're gonna break it. We're going to do whatever we want. We're going to stick together in doing it. And I think Democrats are still, we have always, you know, kind of preached a little bit of moderation. And I think there's a break with that right now, where in order to get some of those unlikely or newer voters out, you're going to have to do more to reach them, and it's going to be a departure with a lot of the traditional centrist policies. Mm-hmm. One of the things, when we're talking about health care, I go back to what happened when Obamacare was being debated in the House and the Senate. I was on the Hill at the time, and all the concessions that were provided for the sake of bipartisanship, and there was not one Republican that supported it. It was like a slap in the face to our democracy. And it continued. And from that point onward, it seemed as if we've just been in this battle to try to have a relationship with Republicans who are insistent that they don't want to do anything that might help the Democratic Party.
So you're saying healthcare would be a huge one
healthcare
for young voters.
Healthcare would be a huge one.
All right, Brian,
yeah.
Speaking of that,
student loans, too. Let me put that in there.
Oh, yeah. Elizabeth Warren talks about that a lot. Brian, speaking of health care, amid continuing debate over Governor Kemp's Medicaid waiver proposal, enrollment in Obamacare in Georgia, as we're in the open enrollment period, is up about 9% over the same time a year ago. Now, we still have some time to go, so we'll see if that holds. But are Republicans, particularly Governor Kemp and the administration, in kind of a box where full expansion of Medicaid would bring in federal money, at least initially, and help with the criticisms that his waiver plan is not going to cover enough people, especially people who are at the poverty level?
Governor Kemp is not only a conservative who wants to keep a tight grip on government growth, he's also a political realist. And a full expansion of Medicaid is not going to pass the House and Senate in the legislature. What he is doing is something that can get bipartisan support and get us over those majority thresholds and into law. And he's not doing it without any opposition. You know, Democrats are obviously going to say that doesn't go far enough. And there are going to be some Republicans still who say, we don't want any expansion at all. Those voices have been muted, but they're there.
So you're saying he's practicing the art of the possible?
Yes. I mean, he is being bipartisan. He is offering a compromise that moves us forward. So, you know, I think that's an issue of a Republican trying to gain ground in that space. But you also have President Trump out there pushing actively for a prescription drug bill that is sponsored by many Democrats in the U.S. Senate, as well as some Republicans in the U.S. Senate, that would allow for Medicare Part D to negotiate drug prices, that would prevent drug companies from raising prices too fast above the rate of inflation. So you see Trump, who was talking about prescription drug prices for some time, still harping on that. That would be a huge win for Trump going into the election year to get something done on drug prices.
If Brian Kemp wanted to actually show up for a test of true bipartisanship, he would actually move for the full expansion. And when you're talking about the votes aren't there. They might not be there with Republicans, but they are there with Democrats. And there is, on the House side, there's only like a 16-member difference. So you mean to tell me there aren't at least 16 Republicans that might come over and support that? And you don't think that he could knock enough heads on the Senate side to get there?
That would be tough. And here's the thing. Governor Kemp, even if he were able to get it over the finish line, he would expend so much political capital doing it that it would be very difficult to get some other conservative reform that he wants passed, because he would lose a lot of his own people with that. And he has just spent a significant amount of political capital on this Senate appointment. He's put a lot into it. He stood by his choice. He's faced down opposition very strongly, and he has every right to do it, but that does cost political capital. That's a fact. And we don't know yet. One interesting thing I'm going to be looking at, Bianca and Dennis, going into the 2020 legislative session, is how much political capital did Brian Kemp spend on the Senate appointment? Last year, one of his primary accomplishments was the heartbeat bill. It passed by one vote in the state house, very tight margin. And you get over that one vote by having political capital, having leverage, having people who are willing to go to the floor for you. Has he lost some of that? We don't know. We'll see.
I don't understand the logic here, because doing something that is what would be considered, I think, a more moderate proposal, a smart one, which is actually covering more people for less money, which is all the Democrats are saying, dude, hey, let's cover more people. It will cost us less. And you're like, nope, I want to pay more. I want to cover less people. Sign me up for that.
I hear you. And that is the Democratic point of view. So your overall point here is, I don't understand why the Republicans just can't think like Democrats. And that's the point that you're making. And the reason why Kip is going the direction that he is because he's got to face political reality. Republicans want to see some skin in the game by the new beneficiaries, people who've got some responsibilities, some premiums, some work or education requirements to get this new benefit. And Republicans continue to be worried that if the federal government ever rescinds the 90-10 split of the Medicaid expansion, that the cost that would then be borne by the state would be so crippling, so overwhelming, that it would block out other priorities that, yes, Democrats want to.
Before we leave, a couple of sad notes. The State House Rules Committee Chairman Jay Powell died unexpectedly. He was a Republican, an advocate for rural communities in the state. But the grief over his passing, Brian, was bipartisan.
Yeah.
His loss will really be felt as the legislature gets ready to take on some serious issues for rural communities right at the end of the year.
Yeah, he's been one of the leaders in the House Rural Development Council. And yes, there was a bipartisan outpouring. The day that the news came out, I got a text from former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Evans, who had served in the state house with Jay, and she had asked me for some contact information for some Republicans, and she goes, you know, Jay was my buddy, and we were, after I had my first kid, Jay was asking about my, you know, will and all that stuff that you got to think about when you have kids, and she goes, I don't have a will. She's a lawyer.
And a very successful lawyer,
and she goes, Jay Powell did my will for free. So what a great – I hope I'm not violating any privacy with that, but I'm sure Stacey would want that story to be told, because it told of the humanity of Jay Powell, and that he was somebody who did have relationships across the aisle in the state house.
When it comes to rural communities, I mean, we sit here in Atlanta, but Bianca, you look at the issues that rural communities face with hospitals closing, for instance, mm-hmm. people leaving rural communities – the struggle to attract business and industry there, losing somebody like a Jay Powell, whatever one's party, is going to make it harder to put together legislation probably as we go at least through this next cycle.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think hearing the news of his passing was, it was such a shock. Just, you know, we're approaching the Thanksgiving holiday, and a lot of the members of the Gwinnett delegation have also expressed their disappointment. I know he gave Beth Moore out of House District 95 an opportunity to actually be a sponsor of a bill that got passed, and so.
And she's,
you know,
a Democrat. We
and
should
she's
point
a
out.
Democrat. Yes, yes, and so I think that there's a need for bipartisanship. There's a need for working together across the aisle, and it's unfortunate that we're losing people that can help get us there.
And on the east side, retired Assistant Covington Police Chief Almond Turner, who was also serving on the Newton County School Board and had for years, was murdered in Mississippi. He had been a leader in Covington for years, helping to get cameras installed in school buses and classrooms and so forth. And again, the outpouring, especially for folks who just read about it and had not heard of him, you realize how important local leaders are. And when one like that is taken, for all the attention we pay to things like the presidency and the governorship, we kind of forget sometimes how important prominent people like that are.
From the moment that the news came out about Alma Turner's passing, my friends over in Newton were, you know, they took to social media to express their shock and grief. And under the circumstances, you know, I'm sure folks have a lot of questions about, you know, what it was exactly that happened or why this had to happen. And I think one of the things that we can all walk away with is to just think about the legacy that we want to leave, because we all do have to go at some point. And what will our legacy be of? What will people say, you know, when we pass on? Will they say, you know, how we made this place better? Or will they have tales of how, you know, how cruel we were or difficult to work with? And I think they would want the former. And I think, you know, Alma Turner encompasses that a great deal.
Yeah. And it all begins, Brian, with community, your neighbors, the place where you live.
On the podcast, we often end with the passing of notable Georgians. And I consistently thank those who devoted 20, 30, 40 years of public service to elected office, particularly local office, where there is no glory, there is no grand title or perks. It's just a lot of hard work, really tough decisions, and tough feedback from your constituents who you see at church and you see at the post office and you see at PTA functions. So it's a tough job, and I'm appreciative to people like him who devoted their life to giving back to Georgia on the local level. They're getting good folks in those jobs is extremely hard.
And that is it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Democratic strategist Theron Johnson this time, Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Hey, thanks to you both for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Go Dogs, beat LSU.
It was good to be here. Thank you.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Bianca is at Bianca J. Keaton. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. Theron, by the way, is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at DENISOHAYER. And if you like this show, please subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We will be back in your feed and in your head soon with some more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.